Bienvenue chez le Diasporiste juif, un podcast où on explore les implications politiques, sociales et culturelles de la vie en diaspora. Nous sommes votre présentateur, Zach Smerin.
Zach, what the hell? Welcome to the Jewish Diasporist, a podcast exploring the political, social, and cultural implications of life in diaspora. We're your English-speaking hosts, Ben Yenowitz.
And Zach Smerin. Sorry, I just don't get that many opportunities to speak French these days.
Well, if you love France, like some lousy baguette eater, you must have enjoyed the guest we had for this episode.
I did. Matty is one of the coordinators of a new holistically inclusive diasporic congregation in Saint-Ouen-sur-Seine, a working-class suburb of Paris.
It's quite surprising that we haven't covered France earlier, to be honest. It's the largest Jewish community in Europe, the third largest in the world, and has some unique characteristics. Namely, that it is majority Sephardic, which results largely from post-colonial migrations from Algeria, where indigenous Jews were granted French citizenship in order to divide and rule the colony in the late 19th century.
Le Shul aims to bring together French Jews who currently have a difficult time finding a home in mainstream communal institutions. While Jewish left political organizations in France have become rather divided on focus, strategy, and rhetoric, the community created by Le Shul provides a spiritual home, much-needed space for diasporic Jews to build unity and psychological strength for the struggles ahead.
We also touched on how the community is formed by both Neo-Hasidism, continuing our exploration from episode 27, and neuro-inclusivity, which Mati specializes in within his professional work.
Thank you so much to everyone who supports our work, both donors and our broader audience. The Jewish Diasporist continues to be a passion project fueled by your continual engagement and support. We need your help reaching as wide an audience as possible. Please follow us on Instagram, subscribe to our YouTube, rate our show on your podcast platform of choice, and critically, share our content with friends and community who you think would appreciate it. In addition, please consider becoming a monthly donor on Patreon for as little as just £1 a month. Ben tells me that this is like you buying us a gumball, but it has a real impact on our show's sustainability. All your support is deeply appreciated and helps keep this show on the air.
Without further ado, let's get into the conversation.
They will not divide us. We will not abide this. We know that together we'll be free.
So I'm Mati Boakye-Bortnik, and I'm one of the co-founders of Le Shul, which is a diasporist, radical, spiritual community based in Saint-Ouen, which is a suburb of Paris, one of the working class, part of the Red Belt, as it's called. And I was born in the U.S. and lived most of my life in Israel and in the U.S., where I studied in both countries. And I immigrated to France a number of years ago during COVID. I grew up with a very strong Jewish background, Ashkenazi background, that was falling, you know, at different points in my life. You know, my parents grew up in Muncie, which is a very traditional type place in the state of New York. And I grew up, my parents themselves went on a different kind of path. And I grew up more in a classical American reform context, but with having lots of family and connections in the Orthodox world and never really fit in any of those kind of places, but was always super attracted to everything Jewish, right? As I think a lot of people who come onto this podcast are, and never really fit in my Reform community that I grew up in, didn't feel really comfortable in my grandparents' Orthodox community or at camp, which was a more kind of modern Orthodox type summer camp. But I decided quite young that I wanted to go to rabbinical school. I knew that I was into this kind of stuff and I wanted to study Jewish topics and work in Jewish community and try to create something, right? And even in high school, when I was always trying to create something that fit for me, right? And, you know, I'm autistic as well and disabled in other ways. And, you know, that's another topic, but it was something I always thought about. And, you know, I went to university and I studied Jewish philosophy and Jewish history and planned on going to rabbinical school, but kind of had a break of faith, so to speak. Wasn't sure what I really wanted to do. I think very common to Jewish young people in their early 20s who are looking for some sort of spiritual connection and getting their heads all messed up with Hillels and Chads and Kabbalah and academia.
Oh, that's the worst.
Yeah, the worst. And I was super fortunate. I studied under Shul Magid at Indiana. That's where he was. He was my thesis advisor. And beyond just being my thesis advisor, was also a spiritual teacher to me at that point, and taught me a lot about the world. And no, and I graduated and I left. And I decided that I actually didn't want to go to rabbinical school, and I had a career and did a few different things. You know, typical kind of story of person who graduates in the height of the U.S. recession, actually the start of it, right? And trying to find themselves, and not, you know, my whole life had been based around going to rabbinical school, and just wasn't going to happen for me, right? I couldn't connect to the community anymore. And I actually kind of, I don't want to say left the community, but stopped going to shul, stopped getting involved in Jewish kind of spaces. It just wasn't interesting to me anymore. But, you know, whenever I would pass a Sfarim store, you know, a Jewish bookstore, I would always peek my head in and look. And when I would see something online, I would get excited. I remember when Zeke magazine came out, that was very exciting to me. And I would always try to find myself back, my way back in and get into it for a little bit more and kind of get out. Maybe for any of the neuroatypical people listening to this and my fellow ADHD folks, maybe you can relate to this. And also, I think a big part of me being neurodivergent, being disabled, also alienated me from the community. Because while everybody speaks of inclusivity, everybody speaks of wanting to be for everybody, and while people will drone on and on and on how Jewish law and minhagim and the Jewish community in general is super based on neurodiversity and different people and accepting everyone, a lot of us also know that it doesn't matter if a rabbi in the Talmud was autistic, maybe. It doesn't change the fact that halakha today is actually used to enforce neuronormativity and, you know, heteronormativity and all of the various normativities that exist. Whether or not we have that queer background and that neuroatypical background in the past, right? Those voices exist, obviously. It's not how it's used. And yeah, I just kind of lost it, right? As far as my Jewish connections. But it made me sad at the same time, because that had always been one of my really great interests since I was a kid and wanting to learn. I was lost without it, but I also couldn't connect to it. And I immigrated to France a few years ago. And at that point, I had been starting to get back into it. And I had been thinking, you know, maybe I want to go back to rabbinical school. And I thought, oh, maybe I'll go into London. I'll study. We can start something new, right? All of the kind of people that come onto your podcast already now, right? All of these things started coalescing, right? In more, and I guess in bigger ways, 2017, 2018, we started seeing that there really was an alternative to the mainstream kind of Jewish world. And obviously there was the Chabura movement already from the 70s, but, you know, we didn't speak about the political element of things, but, you know, as a diaspora, so somebody who believes in that life in the diaspora is valid, and that my spiritual life and my day-to-day life isn't defined by another state, which happens to have Jewish people in it. And, you know, not to say that people who live in Israel are irrelevant or not important or not Jews, right? It wasn't relevant to me. And just everything being about Israel and thinking that you can only be a Jew if you're connected to the state of Israel and you support the state of Israel and its aims and that it has this religious significance, that didn't speak to me, even though I'm Israeli, right? I never looked at Israel as anything more than a country where Jewish people live, and there's a lot of problems with that, and I'm an active member of Omdim Biyachad and Chadash when I lived in Israel, and those are two separate things. You know, the entire Israel-Palestine, I don't know, shit show, for lack of a better term, didn't influence my Jewish life, which I know is very strange for some people to hear, especially in the U.S. and in Europe, but it wasn't part of it, and it made me feel a little bit icky, and it was at this time, slowly before COVID, where I saw that there were other people who also felt that way. There are people who are on the political left, who were active in their communities, were outside of the Jewish community, and whose Jewish values were really informing their own political work, but not in this performative way that oftentimes people use their Jewishness in order to inform their political work, but actually their political work was affecting their Judaism was affecting their political work, and we weren't making, I don't know, concessions to, oh, but what about this with Israel? Or what about this with this thing, right? But actually saying no, right? Like, I'm Jewish. I have religious beliefs. I have spiritual beliefs. I have community beliefs. And being where I am I mean, that's what I am. And I know that kind of sounds a bit rambly, but it always upset me that, like, this idea of, like, going to summer camp and people showing up and saying, this is not your home, you don't belong here. You know, I'm a seventh generation American, right? You know, oftentimes in Israel, people always ask you, what's your Ida, right? And I go, I'm just American.
No, I really appreciate that introduction, Mati. I do think it's really wonderful to be able to hear this path, this diasporic story of you being born in the United States, moving to Israel, spending many years there, and then moving to France. And then just kind of to follow up on that, what was it that led you to France in particular? Because there's many countries you could have moved to, and especially these days you hear a lot about anti-Semitism in France. So what is it about that country that drew you in, for lack of a better word?
Well, you know, what brings anybody to France? Either work or love. And I fell in love with my French partner. And actually, at the time when I was starting to move to France, I had actually planned on moving to the UK. That was my idea, to go to the UK, go to Leo Beck. This is what I kind of had in my mind. Life changed, right? You know, the pandemic came and life started changing. And said that, you know, we wanted to build our home together in France. And, you know, started looking for communities, right? And going to, you know, at this point in my life, I was no longer comfortable going to Orthodox synagogues.
Yeah, just it's funny that you mentioned Leo Beck, because there was someone that we wanted to have on the show. She was a student at Leo Beck and told me that the entirety of her rabbinic class at that school identified as diasporist, which I thought was really fascinating. While, of course, the lack of any clear definition of diasporism meant that some of them identified as both diasporist and Zionist and didn't fully see the contradiction between those. But it definitely kind of speaks to the way that it's interesting that you bring up Leo Beck, and it speaks to the way that, like, diasporism is kind of a zeitgeist hanging over the Jewish community at this moment.
Yeah, definitely. And I think in my day job, right, I'm an autism educator, and I go to communities and Jewish communities and non-Jewish communities and NGOs, schools, businesses, and teach them about autism. And I find that even within, like, the autistic community, other autistic people, words get thrown around all the time. And people don't necessarily know what they mean, but they keep using them. Diasporism is one of those good ideas. And I've met a lot of those kind of students who say, yeah, I'm a diasporist and a Zionist. I believe that the UK or France or the US is my home and that life is valuable here. And I also support the political project of Zionism, right? When they are still looking at the political project of Zionism as what they're reading from the 1890s and not necessarily, you know, or like some Peter Beinart Jewish Currents version of Zionism and not what Zionism is today, right? Which is ultimately the negation of a diaspora, right? This concept of negation of everything that exists, right? We're in exile, so to speak.
Let's talk about this congregation. You moved to France and you don't find a real place to get involved in, and you help set up the shul. Or is it le shul in French? Le shul. Le shul. So how does that happen?
So my partner and I were looking for a Jewish community in Paris where we could go. And, I, you know, we didn't have high expectations, obviously, not thinking that we're going to find a Hinenu in the middle of Paris, right? Or, you know, or a Kol Tzedek, or, you know, a place like this in France. But going to find a place that will be good. And, you know, there are a lot of very nice mainstream progressive, whether it's Reform or Masothi, conservative. And there are lots of really great communities that have really nice tefillah, very nice prayer, have good shiurim, good lessons and teachings and classes. But there was no place that really felt like my home. You know, when I lived in Israel, I felt really connected, even though I completely reject Orthodoxy and traditional Hasidic world. I always kept finding myself going back to these small shtiblech, these small kind of prayer houses and people's houses, and it's tucked away in machzanim and storage units in the basement of a building. Not because I agreed with anything, but I liked the energy, right? You know, maybe some of your listeners or some of your guests who have lived in the Hasidic world and have been there.
Oh, yes.
Know what that feeling is like, right? And I so desperately wanted to kind of recreate something like that. And in the U.S., it exists, right? Like, you have neo-Hasidic, progressive neo-Hasidic shuls all over the place. And minyans, and it exists. And in the U.K., it's also starting. In France, it didn't exist. And there wasn't anything even close to it. So we said, okay, we need to have something like that. We need to have a place where people can come and take prayer very seriously. But there was actually an even bigger mission that we understood, which also is a product of everything that's happened in the last year, in that Jews who are queer, who are disabled, who are neurodivergent, who are living on the margins of Jewish community, don't have a place in France. Now, that doesn't say that people get thrown out the door. Both the mainstream Orthodox synagogues and the mainstream Reform and conservative synagogues believe in inclusivity. They want to welcome everybody. And many of the people try. And some of them even do a good job. But when the makeup of those communities are just a bunch of or Ashkenazi or Sephardic, cisgender, straight people, able-bodied people, neurotypical people, or that's how it's run, right? I don't actually believe that most people are neurotypical. I think most people perform neurotypicality, just like most of us perform cisgender and heteronormativity. There are no communities for us by us. You know, a big thing in the autism rights movement is that there's nothing without us, or there's nothing with us without us. Right? Nothing about us. Sorry. There's nothing about us without us. Right? If you're going to be talking about us, if you're going to be bringing us up, if you're going to be having these conversations, we're going to be involved. And what we saw, and not just me, but all the members of our community, because our community coalesced around a few different kind of political movements and collectives that exist in France. We love small political collectives where people discuss things and go out onto the streets. Plenty of those on the Jewish left. A lot of people saying, you know what? I love this. I have a political home. This is wonderful. I'm with fellow neurodivergent queer Jews doing leftist politics in the street, but I have nowhere to go pray. I have nowhere to go study Hillel Zeitlin. I have nowhere to go share my Sabbatean poetry. I have nowhere to discuss non-gendered Hebrew. And we realized that actually we needed to make a space for that, a space that was specifically spiritual, that is not political, but also, and this is the ironic thing, because we call ourselves a diasporic spiritual community, and I guess that we're not political, but also that this community, we are not existing and basing ourselves on an opinion on Zionism. We are believing in ourselves as building a home here in France, and that is more than valid. That is a traditional Jewish value. And I don't know how familiar everybody here is with Rabbi Tamaris, but what we look at is a big, big inspiration to us that being in diaspora is not just valuable, but it's actually important. You know, this is what helps Jews be both universal and particular at the same time in a non-xenophobic, non-racist, non-nationalistic way.
I think it's interesting you brought up Tamaris. I actually was made aware of his work while I was in Palestine last May with the Center for Jewish Nonviolence delegation I was on last year. I think I learned about it from Rabbi David Cooper, who we had on far back. And that's interesting. His work in the book, A Passionate Pacifist, I've heard is really meaningful, yet I have not been able to get my hands on a copy of it yet.
Oh, well, Benyuda Press is also the publisher of me and my co-authors. Forthcoming book, we'll get you a copy.
You've mentioned types of both Ashkenazi and Sephardi synagogues. When it comes to people that come to your shul, how do you work towards that dynamic? France is quite unique in terms of other large Jewish communities in the diaspora, or the largest ones, in the fact that it's majority Sephardic. I don't know which country is the next predominantly Sephardic Jewish community. How does this impact your organizing in terms of not also just related to the sort of ethnic composition, but also apart from the diasporist factor, which is the one that unites, and I think it's really important that it is that positive, what defines you, what you see for the future. And you've mentioned Neo-Hasidism as well, for example, but how do you combine all of, you know, the different strands of religious Judaism alongside the ethnic makeup into making it that inclusive space that you want it to be?
Not to mention the different minhag, the different customs, the different melodies you might use. How does that play out?
I really, really like this question because I don't get a lot of opportunity to speak about it because, as you said, France is majority Sephardi, and we just take that as a matter of fact. And well, what's super interesting, when you go to a typical French Reform synagogue, right, it's going to be 50-50, and it might still be majority Sephardic. And you might have a Sephardic rabbi and a Sephardic cantor, singing traditional American Ashkenazi Reform tunes that you might hear in Pensacola, Florida, right? Plus some traditional French ones. The whole progressive Jewish world in France is really interesting in that it, but I don't even think by design, just naturally, you have both. And so a lot of people, you know, it's funny, you know, being the, you know, the token URJ person, right? I'll say, oh, that's Debbie Friedman. People don't even realize that it's not Sephardic, right? Because they've been singing that their whole lives as well, right? So very often people don't know. But so when it comes to tunes and things like that, and you come for a Kabbalat Shabbat, we create a new Kabbalat Shabbat every Friday. And that's something that's really important to us, that we incorporate different tunes and different traditions from different members of the community. So what we do, and also we want to be a place where people, we want people who have never heard a prayer, never come in, never seen a siddur before, be able to come in and feel comfortable. And so we create a playlist, and we'll either record it ourselves or we'll find things on Spotify, and we create a playlist. So if you two were to come to us on a Friday night, a few weeks before you come, I get a playlist that's going to have all tunes exactly as we're going to be singing them in Lashon, and they're going to be different every time. And some of them we all like more and they'll come on more, but they're never just one thing, right? It's not just Carly Bach or just Sephardic chanting. We're always trying to have it incorporate lots of different things. And I think it's really important because for us, you know, and for a lot of members of our community, the whole idea of diasporism is that we don't want to deny our cultural differences, right? And obviously both Sephardic, Ashkenazi cultures and all their various subcultures have a lot of very, very valuable things to teach one another. We do want to look at that we are all now Ashkenazi and Sephardi living together, just as Zionism sought to create the new Jew, right? The Nordau new Jew in historic Palestine as this new thing that wasn't Ashkenazi, that wasn't Sephardic. We like that. We like to take the diasporist angle on that. And how can we build a new diasporic culture based on our particular cultures now? Because now we're all living together, right? It's not the 18th century anymore, right? We're all living together. We're intermarrying. My last name is a combination between my last name, which is an Ashkenazi name, and my partner's, which is a Tunisian name, right? And creating our own minhags. And that's how every community is going to have minhagim that are getting started because somebody started a shul, because somebody started a minyan in their house, and we create things. And we're just making new things as we go along. And it's wonderful. We're picking up from everybody. You know, I think it's super exciting. And we always love having these conversations. Oh, where is this dish from? And where is that tune from? And where is that from? And we have these discussions. And it's beautiful that we can sit in. You know, we host, like a lot of progressive communities, we host a Nigun circle every month for Rosh Chodesh. And we don't just do Ashkenazi Niguns. We do all types of Nigunim from all different types of people, and people bring them. And I love it. You know, sometimes you'll have an Ashkenazi person will bring a Sephardic tune, and Sephardic person will bring an Ashkenazi tune. And we're all looking at these things as belonging to all of us, which we can do through these kind of spaces. And it gets me very excited because people just assume that it's going to be like the same everywhere else. And we don't want it. We want it to be really bring what you want and what you're curious about. And let's talk about it. Let's learn it together.
Thanks. Thank you for that overview. It's really incredible to think about how these different communities can come together and create something new while maintaining rooted in these internal diversity. I mean, when I've started thinking about diasporism as an idea, one of the things that I always understood to be a component of diasporist ideas and politics was this sort of radical cultural exchange, as well as this recognition of internal heterogeneity, the fact that there is no monolithic Jewishness, that it is something that is distinct. And it's really interesting to think about how that relates to creating a new culture, which reminds me of, I think it's one of Eric Hobsbawm's books, The Invention of Tradition. The idea that tradition isn't something that's just age-old, something that's always existing, but something that we actively produce through our culture, through our interactions with each other, and what different things we choose to carry on and pass down from generation to generation. Yeah. I was kind of curious, as I know you've identified also as a Neo-Hasidic community, but I was wondering how your Neo-Hasidism relates to your diasporism and how you understand these different components of your Shul's identity.
I would have had a different answer if you had asked me a month ago. And then I have a very good friend of mine and a member of Le Shul and one of the founders of Radical Mitzvah, which is another diasporist leftist queer Jewish collective here in Paris who we do a lot of work with together. They taught me a very new way of thinking about it that I had never thought about before. So I'll tell you how I thought of it originally, but then I'll give a plug to Alexia from Radical Mitzvah on their conception, which is just beautiful. But, you know, for me, I mentioned that I've been fascinated with Hasidism since I'm a kid. And I had a great privilege of going to study under Shaul Magid, who would bring in all of the big minds to come. You know, this is the early 2000s, and would bring in his friends and colleagues to come speak to us in the class. And to be able to learn Neo-Hasidism from the people who are really promoting it, from Art Green, from Rav Zalman, from Shaul himself, right? I think it's fair to say that he's a Neo-Hasidic thinker of his own. And I've always loved Hasidism. I love the idea of sitting around and pouring their souls out to each other and talking about the unity of all things. Like, what is better than that? I mean, that's like, for me as a Jewish person, as an autistic person, that's everything. And for me also, I was able to connect to that from a young age. It's like, for me, it was obvious that these early Hasids were a bunch of ADHD and autistic folks kind of like getting together and looking at the world. And some people are going to roll their eyes when they hear this, I'm sure. But I'm going to point out that both Ben and Zach are smiling as I say that. I related to that. And I really tried to get into that world at one point, right? There was a period of my life where I was davening three times a day. I was praying three times a day at a Bell's shtiebel. Bell's being one of the most reactionary Hasidic groups that there are from the outside. But then when you go inside, everybody has an amazing story, and it's not what it seems at all, like they always say. But ultimately, it doesn't matter if these people are actually super progressive. It doesn't matter if they're super open. It doesn't matter if actually their political beliefs match ours. It doesn't matter if they even think that everything is nonsense, because they're still going along with it, right? They're still going along with in that performance of this reactionary movement. So for me, finding a way to translate Hasidic thinking, Hasidic theology, cosmology, and culture to my life as someone who considers themselves a Reconstructionist Jew, I guess, of some sort. Kaplan's a big influence on me as well and on our community, but that's a whole other topic. You know, I once heard Art Green say that, you know, there's all this xenophobia, there's all this racism, sexism, and all that, but there's also this great stuff. How can we take this stuff out? And you might say, oh, you're not allowed to do that. And I say, you know, I don't care. For me, I want to be able to bring those teachings of the Hasidic masters to everybody. And yeah, and we can talk about how, yeah, I'm taking that out of context. And Judaism as a system is about reading things, taking it out of context, and making up a rule to explain why you've made that up. And people will roll their eyes and say, no, there's the 13 rules and the 29 rules and all this. Judaism is about interpretation. And if I'm going to take, you know, Elimelech of Lizhensk out of his proper context in order to learn something which is meaningful to me and meaningful to you, I don't really care, to be honest. That's not the point of it. And if you're being so pedantic about what is the historical context, again, this is not academia, this is a spiritual community where we're learning things, and how can we improve our own lives through the teachings of others? And I think that's fine. And people are fascinated by it. So Alexia, good friend, member of our community, Le Shul, one of the founders of Radical Mitzvah, which is a queer diasporas collective, which does more cultural and religious and classes as opposed to a synagogue community. And we do a lot of things together, and we hold our Nigun circle together. Talks about Neo-Hasidism as being a form of decolonialism, about actually being able to connect to this very indigenous Jewish way of thinking, which isn't Ashkenazi, isn't Sephardic. And, you know, I always like to remind people that, you know, the Baal Shem Tov lived on the borders of the Russian Empire and the Ottoman Empire and was heavily, heavily influenced by Sephardic culture. And that 99% of Hasidim daven and pray from a Nusach Sfard Sidur, which is basically a Sephardic rite of Sidur with a bunch of Ashkenazi changes, right? Hasidism was the first diasporic movement, if you think of it, like trying to bring together these different things in that regard, right? Kind of like how Sabbateanism was trying to do it right before then, right? And there's a reason why people who didn't like Hasidism didn't like it, right? Because it reminded them of that former kind of subversive movement that tried to bring equality to people. Same thing with Frankism. And what Alexia opened my eyes to is that Neo-Hasidism is a decolonial movement. And so if we're going to be a decolonial diaspora community, Neo-Hasidism is by definition going to be part of that. That is what we have today as our way of connecting back to our roots while also creating something new. And a big thing that they say is that, you know, we don't actually have to go back in time to find this like perfect time, because obviously the early Hasidic days weren't perfect and they weren't great and there was all this stuff, but we can imagine a new future. And that's also a decolonial project. I think that's beautiful. So really grateful to Alexia on that. Yeah.
A lot of food for thought there. And we've been thinking, we've had one person speak about Hasidism briefly in episode 23, but there's been times that we've wanted to talk more about with Neo-Hasidic speakers, including Gashmius, and hopefully that comes about sooner or later.
Not to mention in episode 27 with Seekers of Unity, Zevi, who grew up in the Hasidic movement. You just weren't there for that.
I forgot that episode. This is the personal bias of mine because I wasn't there and I apologize to Ben and Jordan. So, yeah, just to shift gears a little bit, well, bearing in mind the limited time, the thing that's interesting to me, and I've been thinking about this a lot recently, but I would like to hear, if possible, a little bit more, if you could describe the physical space that you hold your events in as much as that's possible in Saint-Ouen. The listeners will probably not know this, but I was born and lived in Paris for the first few years, but I lived in the 15th district, which is basically on the other side of town, and I've never actually been too close to that area, apart from maybe going to visit Sacré-Cœur, which is a little bit on the same side of Paris. So what is Saint-Ouen as a place, and what does your physical space that the Le Choule meets in look like?
So Saint-Ouen is we always joke, depending on who you speak to, that it's like either the Williamsburg of Paris, which is not exactly accurate, it's not technically in the Paris limits. It's the first suburb right over the barrier road of Paris, though it is still on the Paris subway line, and it's only about a 12-minute walk to Sacré-Cœur and to Montmartre in general. And it's a northern suburb, and it's part of what's traditionally called the Red Belt, which is these left-wing, traditional French Communist Party voting suburbs of working-class people, railroad workers, in particular historically in Saint-Ouen, and there is a station there. And these suburbs surround the city, it's called the Red Belt. And Saint-Ouen is also the home of the flea market of Paris, which is the largest flea market in the world. And, you know, like most places, Paris has become very expensive. And for working class and lower middle class people moving out towards the suburbs, Saint-Ouen is a place that has a long Jewish history. And there are Jews have been moving to Saint-Ouen already since World War I. There's a former yeshiva there. There's an Orthodox synagogue. It used to have a much bigger Jewish population than it once did. That yeshiva since closed. But now it's becoming a pretty popular place for young left-wing Jews to move and young left-wing people in general. And so that's where my partner and I built our home. And actually, the Shul is in our home as of today, right? Like most spiritual communities, they start in our home, though our big goal for this year, 2025, or the new Jewish New Year, will be to actually move into a permanent space or a semi-permanent space, as we've outgrown our 40-meter apartment at this point. But we started it just in our living room. And we didn't do that simply because it was convenient, which it was, but we could have rented a space. It was more about we wanted to make it actually feel like a home. You know, our big thing is that we are a community that is made for and by disabled folks. Right? And we want people to be able to actually have access. So we're on the ground floor, so people can come in without having to worry about that kind of access. We want it to be comfortable that people can sit on the floor or sit on our beanbags or our yoga mats or on comfortable furniture and not on typical synagogue folding chairs or wooden chairs, right? We want to be able to have, and we have that, and it's actually our bedroom, a place where when people are getting a little bit overwhelmed because of the lights, because of the sound, of everything, they can go have a space. We've got STEM toys. We have only LED lights. Synagogues typically use fluorescent lights, like in offices, which are extremely dysregulating to neurodivergent people, and actually most people in general. Actually, I never met a person who loves overhead fluorescent lights in an office, but you know, maybe they're out there. And another big thing is that we also have dinner and we're completely vegetarian, alcohol free, that we don't have any sort of something that might dysregulate anybody, that nobody would feel left out of there if they're struggling with alcohol addiction, that anybody can come, whether they are strictly kosher or they're more eco-kosher, and we want everything to be organic, vegetarian, and prepared by our members, and that everybody knows what they're eating and who made it and what went into that. We love talking about what's going into there. And we have instruments, and we encourage people to come bring their instruments. And we don't have, we don't have a mic. We sit in a circle. We sit on the floor. Some of them are in the kitchen. Some are sitting in the office. Some are sitting on the balcony. It looks like going to a party at somebody's house and just hanging out. But we're doing Kabbalat Shabbat and talking Torah and talking politics and the intersection between those. And it's comfortable.
That reminded me almost when I was growing up, I used to go to the Galicia Jewish Museum in Krakow, because that's where the Reform congregation would have its meetings. And that's a very sort of quite distant, everything's far away from you, the special lights, the foldable chairs, that kind. And I remember visiting not too long ago the Orthodox synagogue in Lodz, which is a much closer space. And for all the sort of limitations that come with a Orthodox-only old congregation in a smaller town in Poland, that's something that I remember, that the walls being very decorated comes to mind as well. But something that I've been thinking about a lot recently has been this question of physical space. And some people that are involved in organizing Connected with Me will know that I keep on talking about this. But the importance for anything, whether it is a Jewish congregation or a Yiddishist space or any sort of Jewish left political space, to a political organization, to have its own space that it can decorate, where it can store stuff that isn't in someone's house, that it can organize meetings whenever it wants, even basic things like receiving posts, although there are ways of going about that. And I think that this issue is almost as important, if not the actual questions relating to some ideological or personal differences that people might have within an organization in terms of theoretical ones. It's the really kind of organizing boring stuff that can be important to actually get things off the ground, because once you have that space, that also widens your possibilities in terms of what sort of organizing can you have. The fact also of places being open for the public to come into whenever they want and not having to have someone to be there at all times. In Krakow, that's what I'm super excited about, the work that we've been doing right now, that in Krakow right now, if you want to, you can go 6 days a week from 5 to 10 p.m. You can go in and look on the shelf and see works about the Bund, about Jewish diasporism, about left-wing politics in general. We don't have to be there, but there's information there for you to learn more, to gain contact with us, etc., etc. And so for any sort of organizing thing, we should really not de-emphasize the importance of that physical space, even in an age when a lot of people are able to travel further, or there's a profound importance put on social media. But to be honest, there are groups that, and we could name various different examples on the Jewish left, organizations that have tens of thousands of Instagram followers or Twitter followers, for example. And when you look at the actual impact that they have on just existing physically, that doesn't translate itself much to anything. And I think it should be that social media comes as an effect of that physical organizing, and it shouldn't be considered that physical presence in and of itself.
No, I wanted to add, based on like my own historical research, when we look at the late 19th century Jewish socialist movement, what really helped make it an initial ideological movement was the presence of a media ecosystem. We mentioned it in our last episode, Der Polische Jidl, the little Polish Jew from 1884, the first Jewish socialist newspaper, which was published in Yiddish in Britain. And you had those. And then, of course, in a few years later, you had what was called
Arbeiter Freund.
Arbeiter Front, yeah, the worker's friend. And you had, so you had these different things, but what really allowed it to become a mass organized social movement in Britain and London and the main cities where Jewish immigrants were coming was the presence of a physical space that was open. You had what was called the International Workers Educational Club. And this club was the hub for Jewish socialist anarchist organizing. There were, of course, divides between the anarchists, the social revolutionaries, and the social democrats being Marxists at the time. But having a space that working class people could come and socialize and learn, and just having that space that was not necessarily like a school, but a social space where this was the norm. The norm was you were speaking in Yiddish or, frankly, many, many other languages that were spoken there. But you were there as working class people who shared a general politic of anti-nationalism and socialist future. So being able to have that space, of course, is absolutely vital. And of course, in the modern day, when we're talking about spiritual community, it is a little bit different from that. And we're not necessarily trying to recreate that exact thing. But I would say, personally, from my own research, I would say as we've acculturated, as our culture has become more in line with the countries in which we live, I would say that spirituality actually has become more important. And I think you can see this in like the German context with the rise of like Martin Buber and Gershom Scholem and Martin Benjamin, these different left-wing German intellectuals that were Jewish, but were primarily, like Buber especially, shifting towards a spiritual side of things rather than fixed on the cultural element as from the earlier generation of Jewish socialists.
And all of this is not, of course, to downplay, especially in the case that we're talking about right now, of having that place in someone's home and having that sort of environment as well, which, having had experience with that in my own community for some time, that itself creates a very unique atmosphere of that kind. But I think it is important to think about when we talk about having a place where people can go and spend time in, this is what gives mainstream Jewish communal environments such power. It's that if you want to be in a Jewish environment and you want to be somewhere on a Friday night, you know you can go there. You know you can go to your local community. You know you can go to Chabad, and Chabad will have its doors open. That's what gives it the power. And if the alternative to that is just that, you know, we have 10 people who will be perhaps able to meet up somewhere, but in this location or maybe another location, and we don't really have control of what that location looks like, and we have to rely on one person to bring their things or otherwise we're in trouble. It's not the case of which community do we think has more righteousness or in terms of which one doesn't have problems. But if you look at it from an outside perspective, you can see which place projects power, which place projects confidence, and also which one is more welcome to grow for the outside world.
That being said, I mean, I think to use the Yiddish word heimische, how homely, of course, the English translation there is not so precise. The community that you've had so far, I'd say it has a lot of its own strengths as well of being able to be such a welcoming and inclusive environment. And I think that's such an important thing to learn from and to be able to take forward into this new space that you're hopefully going to be getting in this new year.
We wanted to make it feel like home still, but be a place that people can sit there all day, as you mentioned, and be have this hub where people can sit in here and just schmooze and argue and yell at each other and have. That's the great thing. I mean, imagine if we could just leave it in our house and we moved to another house, that would be perfect.
Just to keep
the books and keep everything the way it is.
I unfortunately do have to go, but it's been an absolute pleasure, Mati, and I hope that you guys are able to cover this last topic because I think it's extremely timely given what has been going on in the last few weeks. But it's been wonderful meeting you.
You too, Ben. Have a good day.
Ben has left us. He's had previous, more important arrangements than the podcast, but we're going to be finishing soon. But before we go, I wanted to talk about this final subject. I mentioned in the introduction of the last episode, the recent arson bombing attack on the synagogue in La Grande Motte in the south of Paris. There was previously a situation that happened back in May in Rouen. And furthermore, there's been this understanding of in mainstream Jewish communal spaces outside of France being a dangerous place for Jews. Yeah. I don't want to get into the subject of discussing this in an academic sense right now. It's not worth rediscussing these things on an anecdotal level, so to speak. But I've been wondering, given the very loud situation in La Grande Motte, how has your congregation and group addressed it in terms of, not for the outside world, you're not, as you said, you're not a quote-unquote political organization, but what sort of impact has it had for you? And how do you imagine going forward in the next few months it will?
I mean, so while La Shul is a spiritual community, it's a spiritual community that's infused by the values of socialism, right? And we are very much made up of people on the political left, right? And we're not embarrassed to say that. And ever for the last year, Jews on the left have not had homes. We've lost a lot of our homes in the Jewish world, right? That we're considered by many in the Jewish community that we're friends with the enemies, so to speak, on the left. And very often on the left, unfortunately, anti-Semitism on the left in France does exist. Does it exist to the same extent as many of our co-religionists might say or how the media portrays it? No, absolutely not. Yet it does exist. And as a community, we take anti-Semitism very seriously. And we recognize where anti-Semitism comes from and what's behind it. And we oppose it. Now, the reality is that, you know, like, we have people who come from every part of the political left in our spiritual community. And everybody has very different opinions on who should be doing what and who could be doing more, who could be doing less, what's talk, what's not talk. We're not always going to agree on that. We have some people, you know, we have a lot of different Jewish collectives who are represented in our community, who are all on the left, but, you know, some from a more radical tradition, some from a less radical condition, some from a more anti-Zionist position, and some from a more Zionist agnostic position. And we're not always going to agree on that. The big thing for us, for those of us, for our founding team of La Shul, which I'm only one part of, was that our community is not defined by that conversation. It's not that we're not having the conversation. We're having the conversation. In our kind of tagline of how we define ourselves, we are a diasporous community, right? Diasporism is why we exist. And I take that to its logical conclusion. Diasporism is why we are here. I don't want 45 minutes of our hour and a half dinner to be talking about who is more X on Zionism than the other one. I don't want to be talking about that conversation. We all agree in principle on what we're about. Because I think that when our entire conversation is about anti-Semitism based on X or Zionism based on Y, we're actually losing the point of, for me, in the logical conclusion to what diaspora is about, is what we're trying to do. We're trying to build a home for Jewish people where we are. And that is politically and spiritually and culturally important. And I want to talk about that. I have my own political collectives in the Jewish community and in the greater community. I'm a member of a trade union. I'm a member of a political party. I'm a member of multiple left-wing Jewish collectives that go out and agitate for change. And I'm proud to be in all of those. And I want our spiritual community to be a place where all Jews on the left can come and pray together and learn about their heritage together, to learn about what our spiritual treasures are, right? No community anywhere. I imagine that most people listening to this podcast are on the left. Has anybody here ever been in a leftist group where we all agree, where everybody actually agreed? No, of course not. I often joke, I'm part of a left-wing Jewish autistic collective. You've never seen people arguing like in that. It's the worst kind of place you can have for arguments. Arguments are okay. We don't have to agree on every last thing. We agree on the broad strokes. Anti-Semitism is a problem. Anti-Semitism is often used as a weapon to shut down criticism. of the state of Israel and its actions. Jewish communities in France are under attack by people, both on the right and on the left. So I would primarily say, me personally, I know you said we don't talk about anecdotes, so I don't know if this is important or not, but the most in danger I've felt in France since October 7th was at the rally against anti-Semitism, where I was marching with my comrades from my political party, of our Jewish section of my political party, where we were attacked by Kahanists. And a woman wearing an Israeli flag was screaming at me and blowing her whistle in my face. So I said to her in Hebrew, to be a smart ass, I told her in Hebrew to stop blowing her whistle at me, which she told me in France, we speak French in France, not Hebrew, go back to your country, which we could all see the great irony.
There's a lot to unpack there.
Lot to unpack there. And like the people who are with her, they understood what she said. They're like, no,
pardon, pas ici.
Yeah. They understood that that was a really, you know, exactly, right? This is exactly what the right wing wants, right? That we should all go back to our quote unquote country. Very good. But the most danger I've felt, the most physical and psychological danger I've received has been from my fellow co-religionists who called me a capo and a Nazi and all sorts of things.
Yeah, I think that reinforcing that idea of positive, and when I say positive, I don't mean in terms of it's happy with just talking about like everything is great as it is, or we want everything to be great. It's just the positive in terms of supporting something rather than opposing something being the key point. And I think that more and more recently I've thought of this idea of like reverse Zionism almost being, rather than anti-Zionism, being something that you can see in some spaces on the Jewish left, which is that it's very much the case that someone might say that Israel is the central part of their Jewish identity and they really hate it, right?
Yeah, exactly. I don't even want it to be the central thing that everybody hates.
And that's not to say, of course, that there's... Yes. I mean, when I've said this before, I've used an expletive in there as well to reinforce the point. In terms of addressing our audience as well, I think that, yeah, and certainly in our audience, nobody agrees on everything, apart from the Trotskyist contingent, where everybody agrees after they make a decision, then they're not allowed to disagree anymore.
Yeah, and everybody leaves, right?
Sorry, that was unwarranted. I'll cut that, maybe. Thank you so much for joining us today, or joining me for this final section. I feel more and more that we're sort of unmasking the background of how we organize our podcasts. And in a way, it scares a little bit because some people think that we're very professional. And so they don't see all the videos and stuff. But last episode, we had Moxie, Sophie's cat, made an appearance. Now today is saying that, you know, we're smiling, reacting to how we say to each other. And now Ben had to leave, which if he didn't say that, or if we don't want to include that, we could get around it.
Seeing how the sausage gets made.
The kosher sausage, of course. Is there anything, any final point that, or final thoughts that you'd like to leave us with?
I would love for all of my fellow diasporists and neo-Hasidim and Jews on the left and people who want to find a progressive Jewish community that takes prayer and study seriously, but from a progressive diasporist POV. And if you're coming to France, if you're coming to Paris, come join us and come pray with us and come daven with us. We also have a lot of online programs and people from all over the world join us. We have a monthly Rosh Chodesh Nigun Circle, what we call our decolonial Nigun Circle, where we not just sing together and learn the history of the Nigunim, but also how we can apply them and take a lesson out of like that kind of underlying meaning of that Nigun. We also have lots of different classes on Neo-Hasidism, on Jewish anarchism, on queering and neurodiverging Jewish texts, lots of really fun stuff that we're doing. You can join online and come join us, come meet us. You know, Paris is a place where people love to visit. We love having people who are coming in, visiting, and just come join us for a Shabbat, and it's beautiful. And that's how we build community, right? Because our community, especially our diasporous community, right, is a community which I really think something I've been so grateful for is that I have friends all over the world and that we can all be with each other when we see each other. And now we've met. And now I know that there's friendly face in Krakow besides Josh, Yeshua, the rabbi. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's wonderful. So I encourage everybody to, you know, give us a follow on, for those of us who want to keep in touch, follow us on Instagram, which I'm sure our hosts will include somewhere in the show notes, and reach out. Love to have you.
Thank you so much.